This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we continue our series of interviews with candidates for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. We'll talk to Dane County Judge Everett Mitchell about the race and some of the big issues facing the justices. Now, President Biden held his second State of the Union address last night, where he highlighted his work on top issues surrounding the economy, health care, and infrastructure. He pushed for more bipartisan cooperation, but also leveled criticism at some Republicans, leading to outbursts and jeers from lawmakers in the crowd.
Some Republicans want Medicare and Social Security to sunset. I'm not saying it's a majority.
Let me give you, anybody who doubts it, contact my office. I'll give you a copy. I'll give you a copy of the proposal. That means Congress doesn't vote. Well, I'm glad to see you. No, I tell you, I enjoy conversion.
Some Republican members of Congress interrupted him a few times throughout the speech and provided a snapshot of the current political landscape in Washington. Allison Prash is an assistant professor of rhetoric, politics, and culture at UW-Madison. Her research and teaching focuses on U.S. presidential rhetoric, public address, and foreign policy. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, maybe it's obvious from that clip, but what stood out to you the most from the State of the Union address?
Well, you know, as you noted, there was obviously this attempt by the president to talk about bipartisanship, but also clear heckling from Republican lawmakers. You know, what I think is interesting is that Biden really utilized this moment to both speak to his desire for bipartisanship, but to also meet the Republicans where they were. I mean, I think in the last 10, 15 years, we've really seen a decrease in some of the political decorum that you would have expect in a State of the Union address. There's the pomp and the circumstance that we often associate with it. But in the last 10 years, you've seen that really decrease. You can think about, for example, in 2009, when Representative Joe Wilson interrupts Barack Obama and says, "You lie." You can think about Nancy Pelosi making the decision to rip up Trump's State of the Union speech in 2020. And so I think Biden knew that he was going into a fraught political environment, and he also took the opportunity to use it to his advantage.
Now, the State of the Union, I know we in the media get really excited about it. How much does it matter as a chance for the president to address the members of Congress in person, of course, but the viewers at home as well?
Well, obviously, he's speaking, attempting to speak to a vast swath of the electorate. I think we often see these memorable news clips that come out of the speech, such as the one that you played in the introduction. But you know what? I think what Biden is doing today and tomorrow, we see this through his visit to the Madison area in particular, is taking key aspects of his message and then sharing them with a broader public. So it's one thing to see the president speaking from the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. It's another thing to see him touting his accomplishments or his message to ordinary people. And that's what he's doing today in Madison, and he'll do later this week in Florida.
Now, these speeches often end up being kind of a laundry list of, here's what we've done, here's what we're trying to do. How much of that did you see in this speech versus the bipartisan outreach, the opposite of bipartisan needling of the other party?
It was, in some sense, a laundry list of accomplishments. A lot of political commentators have been talking about the fact that this was really an attempt for Biden and his advisors to do a test run of some of his key core messaging for 2024. I mean, I think you did see some of that last night. I will also say, though, that there was a bit more fiery language or interest, political spectacle, we could say, in this exchange between Biden and members of the House. But you also saw Biden's clear rhetorical style, his ability in the moment when individuals might have been heckling him to try and get him off script. He was able to engage with them in a way that is quite remarkable, particularly for someone who's been open about the fact that he deals with a speech impediment. And so he was able to really engage with hecklers, with Republicans, and still amplify his political messaging in a way that we haven't seen in a very long time.
Well, it's interesting because I think through his career, President Biden has not been known as someone who delivers a script really well. If anything, people see his ability to react in the moment as something he's actually stronger at. So it seemed like Republican leadership was trying not to give him those opportunities.
I think you're absolutely correct. And aides will often say that Biden is really energized by these individual exchanges from people. Oftentimes, they're talking about ordinary voters, walking the rope lines. This was a really unique moment in which, you know, who knows about the intentions of these hecklers, but it could have been seen as an attempt to really throw him off script, really phase him in a particular way. But Biden looked like he was relishing the opportunity. And in fact, there's this memorable moment where Biden is saying to his audience, okay, stand up for seniors. If you're really saying that you're not going to cut Medicare, cut Social Security, stand up. And at the State of the Union, we pay a lot of attention to who is standing or applauding about particular proposals. And Biden really forced his audience to take a stand quite literally on where they stood on this issue in a way that I think is going to come back perhaps to haunt some Republicans going forward.
Talking to Allison Prash from UW-Madison, Assistant Professor of Rhetoric, Politics, and Culture, looking at last night's State of the Union address. You could join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. When it came to the framing of key issues, we talked a little bit about Medicare and Social Security, police reform, things like that. What do you make of the way that President Biden presented those issues, I think, trying to reach out not just to supporters, but to, I guess, a hypothetical middle America?
He absolutely did. I mean, I think that's one of the things that would characterize what Biden has attempted to do over the last 2 years. There was, you know, this phrase that he kept utilizing in the speech, finish the job, finish the job. He utilized this over a dozen times. And really the message that he was trying to send to, you know, perhaps undecided voters or the middle of the road voter is, you're tired of bickering, you're tired of partisan infighting. Here are the clear policies and proposals that I'm putting forward that's going to impact real everyday working Americans, is how he framed it. And so, you know, whether that reached those particular voters remains to be seen, but I think he was attempting to do so.
Now, it's kind of always election season in the United States. That said, the State of the Union happens about as far away from the next federal election, especially in an odd-numbered year. Is this an opportunity for a Democratic president and a Republican House majority to work together a little bit, to compromise a little bit, and know that some of that's going to fade away before they have to run for election again?
The optimist in me says yes. The pessimist in me says that it remains to be seen how Speaker McCarthy and a new Republican controlled House of Representatives wants to foil Biden's plans. They know that he is most likely, if not certainly, going to announce his decision to run again in 2024. We also know that Donald Trump has already announced his bid for 2024. And so if Republican members of Congress wanted to get something done, they might attempt to compromise, but they may also see their job as an attempt to be a needle in Biden's side going into the general election.
Now, we've got Sarah Sanders delivering the Republican response. She's a governor, of course, but she's best known nationally, I think, for her time speaking for the Trump administration. What do you think of that? What do you make of that selection of her to give that response, which is always a tough gig, no matter which party's doing it?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at what both Speaker McCarthy and also Mitch McConnell said about their selection of her to give that response, it was really stressing a new generation of Republican leadership. There's this memorable line that she says in the speech that I'm the nation's youngest governor at 40, Biden's the oldest president at 80. So she's really trying to put a stark contrast both on Biden's age, which many people see as a liability, both Republicans and Democrats, but she's really trying to subtly suggest that it's time for a new wave of Republican leadership. Now, she doesn't name Trump directly, but there is that inference, and I think that is part of a larger conversation about, is DeSantis, Republican governor of Florida, going to enter the race? Other possible challengers to Trump, and that remains to be seen.
Yeah, some changing of the guard here. Again, two of the oldest presidents in American history have been the last two presidents. But then we see Speaker Nancy Pelosi now not taking on the mantle of minority leader. Are you seeing signs of more generational shifts in who's leading this country?
I mean, I think the general voter would like to see those shifts. I think one of the problems or conundrums that we see is that there can be this kind of dominance of age that continues. It's also the case that it's difficult to look at who would be the next nominee for the Democratic Party, for example, just as it is a conversation about, you know, who would be that next nominee for the Republican Party. We know historically that younger presidential candidates have done quite well. You look at Barack Obama, for example, or John F. Kennedy. Those were, you know, very successful first bids for president. But it remains to be seen how that's going to play out for 2024.
I wanted to ask you more specifically about the decorum issue. You know, we have the heckling during the thing. It was a little more like the British Parliament, mm-hmm. a little bit. Does it matter, though? I mean, are we really decorum-y people in the United States? Do we care if it's a little bit of rough and tumble in this big annual address?
You know, I think that there is the image or the ideal that exists in the mind of the American electorate of what a State of the Union address looks like, sounds like. The moment where, you know, the person introducing the president says, you know, Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States. I think for some people, however, there could be an appeal to the back and forth exchanges between Biden and Republicans in this instance. In fact, in some ways, it does remind me of Trump's rhetorical style and how, as president, he would often interrupt or provide these asides. It's a much more informal style of speaking and communicating. I think there is something different, though, about the pomp and circumstance of the State of the Union. But then again, Biden demonstrated his ability to handle it quite well and, in fact, use it to his political advantage. So it remains to be seen if this will be, you know, a change in how we think about State of the Union addresses or if this is just a one-off. And I don't know. It remains to be seen.
You mentioned the president's visit today to Wisconsin. We get a lot of love here in Wisconsin. We're a very closely divided state when it comes to statewide elections. Do you expect to see lots and lots of presidential contenders make their way through Wisconsin in the next couple of years?
I do. I mean, we saw both in 2016 and 2020 how pivotal the state of Wisconsin was. I think it's also important to remember that Republicans are poised to host the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee in 2024. And so that is always a big boost to the image of that particular party in the state. So I think Biden making the decision to come to both Wisconsin and Madison as his first stop after the State of the Union is incredibly important. I think that we'll see a majority of contenders coming through the state. And I think it's going to play a really important role in the 2024 presidential election overall.
Allison, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Allison Prash, an assistant professor of rhetoric, politics, and culture at UW-Madison. She was with us today to look at President Biden and how he handled his second State of the Union address and some outbursts from lawmakers in the crowd. Coming up, we continue our series of interviews with candidates for Wisconsin's State Supreme Court. That's up next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Four candidates are running for an open seat on the state Supreme Court here in Wisconsin. The outcome of the April general election could shift the ideological balance of the court, which is widely seen as having a 4-3 conservative majority in the current lineup. Before the primary election on February 21st, Central Time invited all the candidates to join us to talk about the race. Yesterday, we heard from Daniel Kelly and Janet Protasiewicz. Everett Mitchell is a Dane County Circuit Court judge where he presides over juvenile court. He's also an adjunct professor at the UW-Madison Law School and serves as senior pastor of Christ the Solid Rock Baptist Church in Madison. Judge Mitchell, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I greatly appreciate your time with us.
Can you start with your basic elevator pitch? Why do you think people should elect you to the state Supreme Court?
Yeah, I believe that our state deserves a justice that reflects the diversity and ideas of our entire state. I've been around the state at least twice with this idea that justice is not simply what you say, it's also what you do. That there are two races going on in our state. One that we rightly focus on reproductive choice, fair maps, decisions, and voting access, where there's also another communication and conversation that is focused on criminal justice reform and justice as relates to access to the courts, how communities of color are being addressed and how they have access to the things that they need in order to make sure that their communities are stronger and made better. And so I'm the best candidate to be able to bring those community conversations together so that we can have a justice that brings those experiences to the courts to follow both the rule of law, but also have the capacity to provide the leadership to address mental health and violence and public safety and just overall integrity of the court, return it back to a place of integrity and strength.
Now, people look at the state Supreme Court and fairly or not say these are conservative justices, these are liberals. The same with the candidates. You are often labeled as one of the liberal candidates in this race. What do you say to people who put that label on you?
I will say that, you know, that creates the tension in these races. I think, you know, really liberal and conservative are nothing but synonyms for Democrats and Republicans, which often creates the inability for us to be able to have conversations with both sides. I think regardless as a judge, there's reason why they're nonpartisan so that you could be able to talk to various groups about the various decisions that they're looking to see in their justices. And I think the labels often create the tension where we aren't able to have an independent, thoughtful, reflective conversation about the values of Wisconsinites and what they would like to see in their justice. So there are those where I talk about my values. And as long as I'm talking about my values, we can talk about how my life and my work has aligned with the need to, you know, keep our community safe, to make sure that people receive the trauma-informed care and that we're not using the criminal justice system as a mental health dumping ground, but rather being proactive to solve the problems so that we are not just locking up futures of people, but that we're protecting futures of individuals. And where that lines up, you know, I'll let the voters be able to decide that.
Now, people might hear that and say, even if they agree with your goals there, they're in a way policy goals, and that's not really the job of a state Supreme Court justice. That's to interpret the law. What would you say to that?
I would say that that's why we need to educate individuals about what the Supreme Court does. The Supreme Court doesn't just simply follow just the rules and make decisions on case. They have significant leadership and legislative responsibilities that they still will address policies. They still address, you know, judicial education. They deal with lawyer regulation. They set budgeting policies for the Supreme Courts. They also can create and bring together committees to solve, you know, current concerns that are happening all throughout our court. I mean, just here recently, the Chief Justice called together a committee to address mental health, right? And starting to pull together, you know, prosecutors, public defender's office, you know, community groups from all throughout the state to start saying what should courts be doing about, you know, mental health and the mental health crises that judges are seeing in their communities. So I think the ways in which we have miseducated our community makes them think that this is limited to just cases, when in reality, there's a whole nother administrative side to the Supreme Court that they're engaging in changing. I mean, quite honestly, when we could not get legislative changes to take handcuffs off of young people in court, we went to the Supreme Court and won a petition before the Supreme Court so that we could put in statute that children are presumed to come into courts without any kind of handcuffs, belts, or restraints. We didn't do that during legislation, but it ended up in the legislation because we were able to go through the Supreme Court to do so.
Talking to Judge Everett Mitchell, a candidate for Wisconsin's state Supreme Court. Judge Mitchell, one of the biggest decisions people are watching for here relates to Roe versus Wade. After the U.S. Supreme Court struck it down, we have this 1849 law in effect in the state. There's a legal challenge to that law saying, hey, there's a law in the 1980s that supersedes it, is the argument there. In a case like that, with two different laws from two different eras, how would you evaluate that case before the Supreme Court?
I'm really not sure how we evaluate it. It's going to be very interesting because the incorrect way in which the United States Supreme Court overturned Roe has really left without any kind of guidance on what is the way for us to evaluate. And so you will see very different degrees across very different states engaging in these conversations about what is the proper standard to evaluate. Is it privacy? Is it due process? Is it equal protection? And I think when we go back and start to assess here in our own state, I think those at least the three lenses that, you know, majority of states, even in South Carolina, when their Supreme Court chose to rule unconstitutional some of their legislative restrictions related to reproductive access, you know, they did it on the ground of privacy and equal protection. So I think there's still going to be some lens in which we need to apply. And I think at least the due process, equal protection, privacy laws that, you know, we have generally, you know, structured other rights around are going to be those that that maybe lawyers and judges will agree are the standards. But at this point, there really isn't any standard because there's no case that has been evaluated in the era post the overturning of Roe.
Once in a great while, parties before the state Supreme Court will ask for or hope that one of the justices recuse themselves from a particular case because of personal connections or campaign contributions. What do you think should be the standard for when a state Supreme Court justice should recuse themselves from a case?
I think the notion that, you know, you are to recuse yourself because of campaign donations it breaks apart the spirit in which we should be having these races in the first place. I've always often advocated for a merit-based system in these races because it costs so much money to be able to, you know, be able to get on TV, to get your message out, to be able to respond in such a manner that, you know, people are going to always be put into a compromised position because you're having to take money from so many different sources, from so many different organizations that are aligned in a certain political direction. And because of that, I don't think anybody will be able to be in a space where if we adopted a recusal that was based on donations, you would literally have a no court whatsoever, anybody ever been able to hear any case whatsoever, because everybody has accepted donations from so many different sources that if one has to recuse, then every last one of them would have to recuse at the same time.
And finally, we would assume that state Supreme Court justices would be collegial, even that when they disagree. That has broken down at some points in recent Wisconsin history. How would you approach collegial relations, even when there's you know, maybe intense debate about a ruling?
You know, it was funny that you asked that question, because last night we were at an event, a lawyers judges event in Milwaukee, where I was talking with Justice Rebecca Bradley and, even my opponent, Dan Kelly. And we had a conversation about the necessity for civility in our courts. And, you know, and I told, and, you know, Justice Bradley and I talked about the idea that, you know, you have to be careful how you talk about people and after you talk about, you know, individuals. You know, as judges, we should be willing to go after decisions, right? We should focus our opinions on decisions and words that are written decisions. But some of these veiled, disrespectful attacks and how we attack individuals' words only weaken our capacity to get into a space and argue about legal ideas and then walk away. I mean, come on, let's be honest with it. We saw Anton Scalia and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, may they both rest in peace. I mean, that was an odd couple, but they found a way to pay attention to the law, right, and not attack each other. And I think until we get back to a place we recognize attacking one another is not the model, but attacking ideas and then step back and say, you know, how does this impact our state? I think that's the model that I'm running on. That's the model that I'm building. And you will not see me do that to any of my opponents, because that's not the mature, reflective, compassionate, kind, or judicial way for us to behave. And Wisconsin needs a value system that allows for us to return that dignity back to our courts.
Thanks to our guest, Judge Everett Mitchell, Dane County Circuit Court judge, a candidate running for the state Supreme Court. We heard from two candidates, Daniel Kelly and Janet Pertazewicz. Yesterday, the fourth candidate, Jennifer Doro, a judge, has not responded to our requests. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, did you know honeybees are, in effect, farm animals that aren't native to the U.S.? A conservation biologist explains the difference between honeybees and the many native bees of North America and the role each plays in our ecosystems. Now, the weeks after the college football bowl games wrap up aren't normally the time when Wisconsin Badgers fans are most fired up about their team. But there seems to be a lot of buzz around new head coach Luke Fickell as he's assembled his coaching staff, added to his recruiting class, and brought in prominent players through the transfer portal. Jake Kokorowski is a Badger athletics reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Jake, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate you.
Yeah, this seems like the opposite time of the year for people to get excited about college football, but I keep hearing stuff. Jake, what's going on?
Yeah, it's, you know, with obviously the hire in late November of Luke Fickell, a surprising hire, really, obviously, with him, how he stayed at Cincinnati, but you know, through the years, and you know, he's been kind of a name in the, you know, coaching carousel of throughout the years, but, you know, he decided to take the Wisconsin job. And, but you've seen with college football too, it's also just kind of maybe as a broader view, college football never ends. It feels like where you have right now, you know, you have the regular season, right, where it's September, late August, September through first couple weeks of January. But you also have, there's, you know, the conditioning in the winter, but there's recruiting. And I think that's part of it with the excitement where, you know, but there's a point in time where, you know, and recruiting is huge right now. It's for any program. It's in all programs are continually recruiting high school prospects, you know, juniors, seniors, sophomores, others, you know, and it's an all year round process. But what Luke Fickell and his new staff did you know, in the latter part of the recruiting cycle for the 2023 class was, you know, they signed a couple of four-star prospects, you know, that, you know, Amari Snowden, Braden Moore are two names. They're defensive backs for Mike Tressel's, you know, revamped defensive scheme for the Badgers. You know, they, you know, so that's part of it. You know, at one point they had eight verbal commitments for that 2023 class. And, you know, in December, after some kids reopened their recruiting process, but they ended with, you know, 15 as of a week ago today, we found out that Jamel Howard Jr., who's a highly recruited defensive tackle out of the Chicago area, he announced his verbal commitment and eventual signing with Wisconsin at a crucial position, which is a nose tackle position on the defensive line. But you've seen this staff with the energy and you're seeing them, you know, make early connections, establish great rapport with players. I guess the kudos goes to them for really, I would say, keeping the recruitments, you know, the commitments of the players that already had committed underneath, you know, previous head coach Paul Christ and whatnot. And then you go further that, and then you look at the transfer portal, where that's where that you've seen a lot of, I think a lot of energy come from there with what they've done in terms of having, you know, 13 scholarship signees come on board, a 2-year starter at SMU and Tanner Mordecai, who's going to be a 6th-year player, but he threw for, you know, 70 plus touchdowns in the last two seasons at that group of five program. You get two other, you know, former 4-star quarterbacks, you know, Nick Evers and Braden Locke to compete for the backup spot too. So there's a revamping of the quarterback room. And on top of that, you know, you have, they have four commitments, you know, signees, if you will, for the wide receiver position, where they wanted to, you know, revamp that room, add more numbers underneath Phil Longo's scheme.
And
you know,
Jake, that's a lot of what's happening on the field. We don't have too much time. I also wanted to get into, it seems like the approach to fans is different. There's a little more pizzazz in the announcements of all these signings you just mentioned. Maybe some changes in what fans will have access to in the preseason. What are we seeing there?
Yeah, it's really a lot too. I think, a couple of things. One, you know, you have like the billboards that they put up there for the fans in the Milwaukee area throughout Wisconsin. They, you know, it was part of their kind of recruiting. They called it a blitz, if you will. And basically it was a presence where right after it was called a contact period where you could start reaching out and seeing recruits. They targeted Wisconsin and they targeted, you know, Illinois. So they called it like a Wisconsin Chicago blitz. And so you saw some billboards up throughout the state of Wisconsin. There was one in Illinois. There's an alumni event just last week, guys, that when you take a look at it, you know, I talked to the president of the UW Alumni Association chapter there, you know, in Milwaukee, and she said that, you know, they registered 375 people for this Big Red Rally, which is, you know, a big event, and Luke Fickell was there talking, and that was 25 above their sellout count, their goal that they had. So there's a lot of energy there. You talk about also coming up April 22nd, they are talking about the launch, which is going to be, you know, essentially it's not going to be a spring game. You know, I know a lot of programs around college football do spring games, but it's going to, sounds like, according from what we've heard from UW spokesperson, it's really just a nice way to, you know, they're going to have an open practice, and then there's going to be a scrimmage involved too, from what it sounds like. So, you know, they have a lot of buzz there. I mean, even with me, I've been on vacation this week, y'all. And to be honest with you, like, I can't stop hearing commercials on the radio here and there. There's, you know, I've seen like at least one TV ad. So you're seeing like, you know, we haven't dove in yet to just if they're marketing more or just how much money they are. That's an idea I'm hoping to do once I get back from vacation. But it's one of those things where this is, you know, there's a lot of momentum for the fans. You're seeing, you know, there's a lot of momentum or energy there. We'll just see what happens because they, you know, you hear about it off the field, but on the field, you know, they haven't even gone on to spring football where they have 15 practices coming up maybe in the, we have to check dates, but it's in the spring where they have, they're allowed 15 practices with these players and they have to implement a new offensive scheme. They'll have to see what they do with the defense now and trying to merge two different defenses. But there is a lot of buzz with Wisconsin football right now.
And Jake, just in our last minute, on the offensive side, do we have a sense of what the game is going to look like? Meat and potatoes running game, high flying passing game. What are we expecting?
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, Phil Longo comes over from North Carolina. He's the offensive coordinator and quarterbacks coach for Wisconsin. He brings what they call an air raid scheme, but, you know, which is very much a passing scheme. It's a different type of passing scheme. Mike Leach at Mississippi, you know, now previously at Mississippi State used that, you know, throughout his various stops, you know, and many others throughout college football and the pros use some form of an air raid offense. But, you know, so you should expect a little bit, a lot more passing, I would say, a lot more balance, but they're not, you know, they're not going to go away from the run game, which has made Wisconsin so prevalent in what they've been known for, right? You also have a 1-2 punch in Braylon Allen, who's going to be a junior, along with a senior in Ches Malusi, who could be a great 1-2 punch. But I would expect more passing out of them and out of the Badgers, especially with, you know, they have, I think it's 12 or 13 scholarship, or I think it's 12 scholarship wide receivers that would be on its roster for this season at the moment. And so, you know, there could be a lot of, I think there's going to be a lot more energy that way in terms of the passing game and creating opportunities that, you know, Wisconsin's running game won't have to block, you know, 8 or 9 guys in the box each and every play. And I think Wisconsin can do more that way through the air.
Jake, we'll leave it there. Thanks for bringing us up to date.
Excellent. Y'all have a great week. Take care.
You too. That's Jake Kokorowski, Wisconsin Badgers sports reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, with us to discuss some of the buzz around the Wisconsin football program and the early days under new head coach Luke Fickell. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a classic bar tradition that takes place all year long.
The Meat Raffle, a beloved game where the prize is a frozen turkey, a box of steaks, or a chain of sausage links. For writer and vegetarian Patty C., winning a package of meat can bring on peak joy at her favorite local taverns.
A vegetarian walks into a bar for the Meat Raffle and air conditioning. I know it sounds like the start of a bad joke, but I recently visited Heartbreakers Bar and Grill to try to win packages of frozen meat on a 97-degree June day. My husband, Bruce, calls this stretch of Highway 00 near our house the Lake Halley Strip. A little less bling than the one in Vegas, but entertaining in its own way. I've been a vegetarian on and off since high school. For the last 15 years, I've eaten mostly a plant-based diet, but I still enjoy making fall-off-the-bone pork roast, slow-cooked barbecue ribs, or rare steaks and burgers. I'm also an ex-smoker who will light your cigarette. A meat raffle is like every raffle. Buy a ticket and wait for your number to get called. As a Catholic, I've been playing this sort of game since I could hold my own paddle, usually a paint stick with markered on numbers. At each church picnic, I won more cakes or pop bottles than my family could carry. Meat raffles are a long-standing Wisconsin tradition, from small-town VFW halls to big-city hipster bars, enjoyed by 90-year-olds to 20-somethings. Turns out, World War II-era meat rationing in Britain prompted the first meat raffles. People pooled their meager protein supply, and some lucky chap won enough for a feast. This concept soon caught on in the United States. Years ago, when Bruce first read Meat Raffle Tonight on a Highway 00 tavern marquee, he thought it was a cool band name. We still laugh about that. Other businesses away from the Strip, like the Eagles Club or Lake Halley Sportsman's Club, hold meat raffles for local charities. The Eagles takes a break June and July. That means for 10 months of the year, a winner could bring home the bacon 3 nights a week, just in Lake Halley alone. Each time you buy a drink at Heartbreakers on Tuesday after 5 p.m., you get a meat raffle ticket. Where else do the odds of winning increase the more you drink? The raffle begins at 6 sharp. The The second number called is mine. I whoop my way from our table to the bartender to verify my ticket, and then whoop some more to the spread of frozen meat. It's as if my name's just been called on The Price is Right. Only today, it's not Bob Barker, but the 20 or so other patrons who smile patiently while yet another middle-aged contestant screams. I poke through the prizes, a two-pack of ring bologna or a whole chicken, a bag of cheese curds or beef sticks, pork tenderloin or a rack of ribs. I settle on a pound of jumbo shrimp. I never won crustaceans before, so of course I hold the frozen bag over my head like a trophy and whoop my way back to our table. We order another round of drinks. Soon my cousin's number is called. We all cheer. She chooses the ribs. Later, Connie teases me, "Think there's a vegetable raffle somewhere?" Bruce says no one would go. I would, of course. And you know, I'd win something.
Patty C. is a writer from Lake Halley, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll learn about the differences between honeybees and the many native bee species of North America. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, you may have heard in the last few years that honeybees were under threat after an increase a few years back in a problem known as colony collapse disorder. Those honeybees are a non-native species in North America. They play a huge role in agriculture, both in honey production and for pollinating a wide variety of crops. But the concerns about honeybees and their importance in agriculture may have overshadowed a big ecological problem. Many of the nearly 4,000 bee species that are native to North America are under different forms of threats because of habitat loss, pesticides, and other reasons. Rich Hatfield is a senior endangered species conservation biologist and bumblebee conservation lead at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I want to spend a little bit of, or most of our time on the native bees. I want to touch on honeybees for a moment. We might look at bees and think bees are bees. Honeybees have a very different background and story in North America. Can you tell us a bit about that history?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, they're not native. They were, so they weren't naturally here, but back in the early 1600s, as Europeans were moving to North America, because honeybees provided a source of sugar and also a source of wax, they decided to bring them over. And the earliest records were in the early 1600s, I think 1620s. And I think their first arrival was in Jamestown, Virginia. And records indicate that by sort of the mid-1800s that honeybees had reached to the West Coast and been spread by people all the way out there. But all of the history of the European honeybee or the Western honeybee coming to North America involves humans bringing them here. They weren't here on their own. Although it is worth noting that there is a early fossil of a related species, a related honeybee in the genus Apis that was found in Nevada a few years ago. So there may have been a native honeybee at one time, but that was millions of years ago and went extinct before people were ever in the picture.
And then let's turn to native bees. Thousands of different species native to the continent. I understand we've been talking about honeybees. The native bees of North America, none of them produce honey. Do I have that right?
None of them produce any measurable amount of honey. We have around 50 species of bumblebees, and they may produce sort of small pockets of honey that they feed their larvae when they're developing. But almost all of our native bees spend their winter hibernating. So they sleep through the winter. So they have a different strategy for surviving, whereas honeybees spend all summer making that honey. So they have something to eat in the wintertime, and they overwinter sort of alive, which is different than our native bees.
What are some of the main strategies of overwintering, a big issue for a native bee here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, most of them are overwintering in a small hole in the ground, probably, you know, in your garden or in a yard somewhere. Some of them also overwinter in like pithy stems or twigs of trees or shrubs or even perennial plants. And so actually leaving some of that material in your yard is really important. Leaving some of those dead stems up and actually leaving some of the leaves on the ground provides really important insulation that protects those animals through the winter.
A lot of your work, of course, has to do with endangered and threatened bee species in North America. How endangered are some of these bee species?
The short answer to the question is we don't really know. There are, I think you mentioned there are thousands of species of native bees to North America. And so in the United States and Canada, we have somewhere around 3,600 species. And for most of those species, we have very little understanding of their conservation status. But we do have a pretty good understanding of the conservation status of bumblebees, which are fairly well studied. Most people are probably familiar with them. They're large, robust, black and yellow for the most part, and they're fairly well studied. And we have some indication that around, or not some indication, the data indicates that around a quarter of them are facing some degree of extinction risk. And several of them are critically endangered. One species, Bombus franklini, or Franklin's bumblebee, which is native to Northern California and Southern Oregon, actually hasn't been detected since 2006. And some folks actually think it may already be extinct. And then there in Wisconsin, you know, you have the rusty patch bumblebee, which is a federally listed endangered species. And so the two species I just mentioned, the rusty patch bumblebee and Franklin's bumblebee, are two bumblebees that are federally listed as endangered. And then there are actually seven yellow-faced or hyalaeus bees that are endemic to Hawaii that are also on the endangered species list. So I know that's kind of a long answer to your question, but in short, it sounds like really when we start looking at the data that around a quarter of the species are probably facing some degree of extinction risk.
What are a couple of the biggest reasons that these bees are endangered?
Well, you mentioned them in sort of your introduction of the segment. You know, habitat loss is a major one. The use of insecticides is also incredibly important, especially over the last, you know, 20 to 25 years or so, has been an increasing use of systemic insecticides, which are water soluble and get into plants and are expressed in the pollen and nectar, which are the only food for bees. So that's a really important source of a threat for them. And climate change is also a major factor as well. It's changing the time at which our plants bloom, and it's causing sort of crazy springtime, winter storms, and other things that are just impacting their life cycle. And so all of these factors sort of keep piling on top of each other, and you get a scenario that is commonly referred to sort of as a death by a thousand cuts. And another factor that's really happening, especially to some of our bumblebees, is disease is a major factor. So, you know, you mentioned honeybees at the beginning. There's some pretty good evidence that shows that when we move honeybees around, we're actually moving diseases around with them as well, and they can pass those diseases to our native bees as they visit flowers with each other. And there's also a commercial bumblebee industry that is believed to be amplifying and spreading diseases throughout the country. So a lot of threats out there. But the good news is a lot of those things are things we can do something about. We just need to band together and work to mediate or to get rid of those threats.
And very briefly, just in our last half minute, you mentioned we can leave our yards untidy in the winter to help. How about our, can we make a difference literally by planting native flowers for the rest of the season?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the great things about pollinator conservation is it's a build it and they will come scenario. If you start putting habitat in the ground, and the Xerces Society has a ton of resources on our website to help you do that, you will bring bees there. And that's what we're really encouraging folks to do, is to focus on building habitat rather than, say, getting a honeybee hive, because you may be bringing them into the system that doesn't have enough food to feed them already. So we want to focus on building habitat, and that will support our native bees and the honeybees that are already on the landscape.
Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Rich Hatfield with the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. He talked to us today about native bees, many of which are endangered or threatened, and how to help them out around North America. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it can be hard to have good conversations about difficult topics, but it can be done. We'll get some advice with the authors of the new book, Say the Right Thing. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.